Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Alex Jones on trial is one of the biggest media stories of the year. And the headline right now on CNN.com, Thursday night, August 4th, says jury finds Alex Jones caused $4 million in damages to two Sandy Hook parents. But this is just the beginning, even though this court proceeding has been going on for quite some time. The first finding of compensatory damages was around $4 million, but now there will be a ruling about punitive damages. Those are awarded when the court finds that the defendant's behavior was especially offensive. And the defendant in this case is Alex Jones. And there are other trials coming up as well. Other questions about whether we're all now living in Alex Jones's America. So let's get to those questions here on this week's Reliable Sources podcast. Let's cue the music. I'm Brian Stelter, and this weekly podcast is our chance to go in depth with media leaders and newsmakers, talking about the story behind the story. In these defamation trials, these cases that have piled up against Alex Jones, are really a test of the courts, and a test of these juries and judges who are being challenged to look at these broadcasters who lie for profit. Jones put up a defense in this case in Texas. It's been in the headlines all week, but on Thursday evening, the jury responded with a $4 million damages decision. And like I said, there's more to come. So I asked Oliver Darcy and Jennifer Murchia to talk with me about this. We actually taped on Thursday afternoon before we knew the exact amount of the damages ruling. But as you're going to hear, this conversation was much broader about Alex Jones, what he represents, and the future legal challenges he faces. All right, so let's get to it. Oliver Darcy is here with me in New York. And in Texas, Jennifer Murchia, she is at Texas A&M University, a professor in the Department of Communications there. Jennifer, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me on.
And Oliver, let's have you give us the lay of the land, the various legal proceedings, because there are so many involving Alex Jones right now.
Sure. Right now, we're following one of four trials that are set to take place basically over the next few months. So this is a trial that will determine how much Alex Jones owes the parents of one Sandy Hook victim. There's another trial that's taking place or set to take place in Connecticut that's going to determine how much Alex Jones owes different families up there. Then another trial set to take place back in Texas to determine how much Alex Jones owes another set of parents in Texas. And then finally, there's a bankruptcy hearing because Alex Jones's main media company, Free Speech Systems, which is the parent company of InfoWars, it filed for bankruptcy on Friday. And so there's a bankruptcy, you know, hearing that's taking place and making its way through the courts back in Texas. So there's a lot of legal action swirling around the country from coast to coast almost.
Yeah.
But it also comes at a time, I think, in the last few years when the proliferation of conspiracy theories and lies has really accelerated. And I think this might be a reminder that not only are there real-world consequences to lies, as we've seen spotlighted during this trial, as right. The parents have testified, but also there are consequences for the people lying. If Alex Jones is hit with $150 million that he has to pay out, that is a big consequence for telling those Sandy Hook lies that he is going to have to grapple with.
But just one more question for you, Oliver. Alex Jones doesn't have that money, does he?
You know, it's very unclear how much money Alex Jones has. I think that's what we're learning from the bankruptcy proceedings, right? So this week, for instance, the chief restructuring officer, who just came on the company in June, said that he learned that there was $9 million in cryptocurrency donations that went straight into Alex Jones's pocket. That's just one, side thing that's happening. during the trial, we've learned that at some days, Alex Jones's media company was making upwards of $850,000 a day. And the attorneys for the Sandy Hook families, they're in the bankruptcy court, and they're suggesting or accusing Alex Jones of basically draining or siphoning off money from Free Speech Systems so it looks bankrupt, but having withdrawn it. And if you look in the bankruptcy application or document, you can see that it has had about $62 million withdrawn. And the only person really that can do that is Alex Jones, because he's the sole owner of the company.
Jennifer, let's bring you in on that $800,000 a day. Now, the claim in court was that was an especially lucrative period, right? He wasn't making that on an average day. And maybe in 2018, on those days where he was making almost $1 million a day, it was around CPAC and things were going really well for him. But this is a larger, this tells us something larger about how you get rich through conspiracy scams. How would you break it down?
Yeah, absolutely. The first thing you need to do if you want to get rich with conspiracy scams is you need to go on your television program and you need to scare the crap out of your audience. You need to tell them that you are the only one who will ever speak the truth, that everyone else is a liar and corrupt, and it's all, you know, the Twilight Zone out there. Nothing is as it appears. And then you, sell them emergency preparedness supplies and other, you know, snake oil items that appeal to those kinds of viewers that you have scared. And then you just sit back and collect the money. One of the things about InfoWars is that it's essentially QVC. I mean, it's basically just running these nonstop promotions all day long, interspersed with, conspiracy content.
Did it blow you away to hear that $800,000 figure when it came up in court this week?
You know, it was a big number, but I had read some other information about how much money InfoWars was making. And, they made a ton of money off of selling ads when they were still platformed on YouTube. So when they were streaming, they were making a lot more money than, just from the snake oil that he was selling.
And Oliver, you were in the middle of that deplatforming story, so to speak, in 2018. You were the one that asked a simple question to Facebook about moderation policies. Can we confidently say that InfoWars did suffer, financially in terms of influence after being taken off of the Twitters and Facebooks of the world?
They've certainly not had, I think, the reach that they once did have, right? I mean, obviously, because they no longer have access to the millions of followers who had subscribed to their pages on Twitter, on YouTube, on Facebook. And you've seen Alex Jones even, not the best person to take the word for, but he said that it crippled them. Huh. And under depositions, in depositions, other people who work in his media empire basically said the same. Now, they did say, I think his father, who's in charge of the company or was in charge of the company, said that they were still able to make a lot of money off of the pre-existing InfoWars audience, which is already sizable. But where it really hurt them is acquiring new customers. They've had a hard time acquiring new customers. Which is interesting. So,
and also the word customers is really vital there. It is a business transaction. It's a customer relationship. Jennifer, you wrote a lot about this in your book, Demagogue for President, The Rhetorical Genius of Donald Trump. You talked about Jones and how he built up his following and did help Donald Trump eventually win the presidency in 2016. So as we're talking about the Alex Jones of 2020 and we're watching him on the stand and we're seeing him sweat, literally sweat, we're almost like looking at we're talking about an echo, right, of a man that was at his prime many years ago. The Sandy Hook lies, for example, were many years ago at this point. And now the judicial system is catching up.
Yeah, it's taken a long time. I like to say communicate irresponsibly and find out. And I think that that's what's happening now for Alex Jones. And finally, you're right.
What do you mean by that? Communicate irresponsibly and what?
Find out. Some people say that in a little less PG way. But for me, it's really about his irresponsible communication, right? That's what is at the heart of my critique of conspiracy theory and the way that he deploys it, the way that he manipulates his audience, the way that he manipulates reality, the way that he uses his platform to attack, to smear, to distort. And I think that that's what's at the heart of the Sandy Hook case as well. So he's been communicating irresponsibly for a really long time, and no one's been able to hold him accountable. And so I'm really glad to see that that's what's happening at this moment.
And there are, as Oliver said, other court proceedings coming as well. But as much as Alex Jones, the man, may be hobbled, may be brought down by this, is it fair to say that Alex Jones, who was at one point, InfoWars was like this rural, suburb, it was one neighborhood off in the distance. But now what he represents in that conspiracy theory thinking, It's downtown. It's in the heart of the city. It's everywhere. It's mainstream.
Yeah, absolutely. This is the thing about what happened in 2016. He latched on to Trump. Trump latched on to him. Obviously, Roger Stone, was a mediator between the two of them. And what they did was they mainstreamed and normalized these right-wing conspiracy talking points. One of the things that I tell the story in my book is of how Donald Trump learned to say that Ted Cruz's dad had something to do with the assassination of JFK. And that story came from InfoWars. It came from one guy who was a regular contributor, Wayne Madsen. He was the only source for that story. It was pure speculation. And it moved from Wayne Madison to InfoWars to the National Enquirer, to Donald Trump, to eventually CNN and other networks. Propaganda scholars call that narrative laundering, where you take, a dirty or tainted narrative that has no basis in reality, and you reuse it and recirculate it, recycle it so many times that nobody knows what the provenance is. And Alex Jones has been a central node of creating those narratives and distributing those narratives on behalf of other people. It's due. Like, all of this comeuppance is really due for him.
So this information laundering, I feel like hundreds of people are doing a version of what Alex Jones used to do. But is Jones himself, is he still a relevant part of that network?
I think he is. He's still clearly very connected to the right-wing media ecosystem. He was at January 6th. He was there with his bullhorn leading the crowds into the Capitol. He has certainly been a part of the disinformation around COVID and the response to COVID and vaccines. He's still a player in all of these major issues that are affecting the nation.
Still a player.
And he's what's interesting is, while he has been deplatformed and rejected by most of society who has come to realize who he is, he's over the years become more accepted by the right-wing media, like the major players there.
That's a great point. He has a book coming out later this year, and Tucker Carlson blurbed the book.
For a long time, it was pretty normal for people in right-wing media, people on Fox, to be like, oh, Alex Jones, he's crazy, everyone knows it. Now you don't really see that. Now you have guys, like Brian said, like Tucker Carlson, who commands sizable audiences, who are essentially going to bat for him, I find that to be an interesting phenomenon. So as he's been rejected by the rest of society, he's been more accepted by the right-wing media.
If you go through the blurb, these aren't all blurbs. Some of these are just like the publisher quoting praise of Alex Jones.
Right.
But the quotes are from Joe Rogan, Steve Bannon, Roger Stone, Donald Trump, Tucker Carlson. So that really does show what you're saying, this acceptance of Jones. And isn't it about more than acceptance of Jones? It's acceptance of his ideology.
He doesn't really have an ideology, right? Well, that's the interesting thing about him. He's a right-wing media star, and he obviously leans, I guess, obviously for small government and those things. But really, it's his theatrics that have pushed him to stardom. And it's the same theatrics, I think, that Donald Trump deploys on audiences, and that's made him so popular. It's less like a coherent philosophy. He's not necessarily an intellectual on the right. He's a guy who they see as fighting for them and putting on a hell of a show as he does it.
Jen, would you agree with that?
I would absolutely agree with him. And it is the right absolutely embracing the infowars, right, as a form of politics. And I think that that is so important to understand because so much of political discourse is about controlling political discourse. And what Alex Jones has done with his, you know, conspiracy theory formula is he has provided a fantastic example of how you create, circulate, amplify, and control the discourse using information warfare.
There was a quote from the most recent trial that you shared on Twitter. It was Jones saying, "You can't be told about the Matrix. You got to see it." Tell me why that stood out to you. What is he saying about his show and about the information wars?
Yeah. So, you know, obviously it's a trope on the right hand media ecosystem, you know, to say that you've been red-pilled, which means, of course, that like in the Matrix, you have been shown reality. And once you've been shown reality, you can't unsee it. And so, you know, Alex Jones positions himself as the heroic figure of Morpheus. He's the one who has access to the Matrix, can show you how it functions, you know, and can help you to destroy it. So, you know, again, you know, positioning himself as the only truth teller, the one who will tell you the god-awful truth about reality as it really is, you know, and isn't a part of the mainstream media ecosystem that is, in fact, the Matrix.
Yeah. What really bothered, I mean, there's a lot of things that bothered me about his testimony. One of the things that really bothered me was his claim that with regards to Sandy Hook and the massacre, he just had questions. He just had questions like lots of other people. He just wanted to get answers. And the reason that grinded my gears so much is because he doesn't control a newsroom that sends reporters out to find out actual answers. He wasn't dispatching reporters down to the courthouse to dig through the documents to get to the truth. He was just ranting into a microphone to sell whatever pills he's trying to sell. But that idea that, I'm just asking questions is a rhetorical technique that I wish we could just bury, Jennifer.
Yeah, absolutely. It is a really strong signal that we're talking about the language of conspiracy theory, right? Because the first step is, I'm just asking questions. I have concerns. The second, step is, but why won't they even let us ask questions, right? And so you know that—
And that's where Tucker Carlson lives, by the way.
Right.
He lives in the, why am I not allowed to ask this question world?
And that's all he does, too, is ask questions and say that.
They won't even let us ask. Right.
Right.
So with regards to this current trial, haven't we seen him wiggle his way out of these situations for years? $10 million or $50 million?
For years. And this might be an instance where he's no longer able to wiggle out, although I saw him on his show, I think this week, saying, you know, that he had a strategy for how he was going to keep delaying and, you know, never pay. Anything real. But, you know, I think for a lot of people in America who don't know who Alex Jones is, you know, they know the Sandy Hook massacre. They know about those murdered children. And, you know, they find it reprehensible and disgusting. And so I think for a lot of people in America, they would like to see somebody held accountable for that. And so maybe, you know, maybe it doesn't stop Jones, but maybe it makes some other people feel better about reality, you know, that they can recognize it, you know, that they're not being gaslit by Alex Jones anymore.
Hmm. I think a lot of the American public has got cynical about the judicial system and the way it works and perhaps into thinking that certain stars don't have to, you know, follow the same rules. But I do think that while it has taken years to get to this trial here, the judicial system is working slowly, but it is working. And Alex Jones is going to have to comply with whatever happens in these trials. So, it might take a while. I think maybe if he initially stops complying or doesn't turn over the money like he's supposed to, or whatever the case, it might take some more time in court. But eventually, it's going to happen. And I think you've seen this with the Connecticut attorney representing the Sandy Hook families. He's saying, we have an endless well of patience, and we are going to see this case until the end. And I don't think he's exaggerating there. I think these Sandy Hook families are very determined, and Alex Jones has some big problems on his hands. And he might also now, keep in mind, have additional problems So these are civil cases happening, but it's possible he just perjured himself in front of this court, and that carries its own, you know, issues for him. And so, you know, right now in the next year is Alex Jones, you know, we don't know where he's going to be, but I don't know, in 5 to 10 years, like, I think the full weight of the judicial system is going to hit him, and I don't think it's going to be pleasant.
All right, more questions about this in just a moment. Quick break here on the Reliable Sources podcast, and we'll be right back.
This podcast is supported by Sleep Number. Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores? Sleep Number does that. Only Sleep Number smart beds let you each choose your ideal comfort and support, your Sleep Number setting. Sleep Number smart beds learn how you sleep and provide personalized insights to help you sleep better. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. Temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent. This week on Chasing Life...
I'm sorry that the Great Barrier Reef is no longer great, that we value Amazon much more than the Amazon, and that the waterfront neighborhood where you were growing up could be condemned by rising seas before you're old enough to apply for a mortgage.
That's my friend Bill Weir, CNN's chief climate correspondent. He's optimistic about the planet, and he's optimistic about our ability to take care of it. Listen to Chasing Life wherever you get your podcasts.
And we are back here on the Reliable Sources podcast. I'm Brian Stelter. This is my taped conversation with Oliver Darcy and Jennifer Murchia. We recorded this before we found out that Jones has been found liable for $4 million in compensatory damages. Now there will be a decision about the punitive damages as well. You can read all about that in our nightly Reliable Sources newsletter. Whenever the news comes in, we'll have it. It'll be at reliablesources.com. But let's get back to the conversation now about Jones more broadly and what he represents in the media discourse. Professor Murchia, you're at Texas A&M University, teaching rhetoric and in politics. What will you tell your students in the fall semester about all things Alex Jones?
I think I'm teaching argumentation this semester and propaganda, so two different classes. I imagine that Alex Jones will come...
Both relevant to this, yes.
I imagine that Alex Jones will come up in our propaganda course. In fact, I end the semester with a discussion of weaponized communication and Alex Jones and Donald Trump and how they use language as a weapon, which I think is a pretty solid way to describe propaganda today. So we'll spend the last week or so talking about Alex Jones and probably these court cases.
When you're thinking about this, is there any version of Alex Jones that exists on the left in the U.S. or any version of a Jones in other countries? Like, is he kind of a uniquely American right-wing phenomenon? Or do you fit him into more of a historical context or see versions of him elsewhere?
Wow, that's such a great question. I think that he's probably the most successful version of Alex Jones that's available.
I would get my brain pills from.
I think that other people have tried. I mean, you could even say something like The Onion, right, which is satire on the left, is a kind of version of this, right? Like if The Onion were trying to present itself as really news instead of a satire, then maybe you could put them in the same category as Alex Jones. But, I think that no one has had the access to political power that Alex Jones has had in his sort of genre or niche. I think when he latched on to Trump and Trump latched on to him, I mean, that was a mutually beneficial relationship between those two. And I don't know that, you know, people expected Trump to win at that point, but You know, Alex really fed him all kinds of talking points that, you know, I was able to trace out in my book. You know, it was almost like a subtext of this, the narrative that I told was like, oh, and Alex got him to say this and Alex got him to say that. And one of those things is, you know, Alex and Roger Stone got Trump to say that the election was going to be rigged and to do the Stop the Steal thing in 2016. And they did that, you know, with no basis, with no evidence at all. It was just a talking point that they came up with in the summer of 2016. And Trump started to say it immediately, right after they told him to.
Wow. And then you draw a straight line from that to January 6th and to the plaintiff's lawyer, the Sandy Hook family's lawyer, saying he's going to hand over the text messages that he obtained from Jones's phone and give them to the House committee investigating January 6th. And there could be, I mean, if he's able to turn those over, Oliver, there could be something very newsworthy in those text messages.
I would say there would be a lot of very, very newsworthy things in those text messages. If you keep in mind that Alex Jones would frequently boast that he knew about things happening in the White House on his show, and the fact that we know that he does communicate, obviously, with some key figures in right-wing media, I mean, there are probably some very interesting conversations on that phone. And I would bet that he's not too happy that it's possibly going to end up in investigators' hands. Remember, he testified in front of the January 6th committee, and he boasted that he pled the fifth more than 100 times. So he was not really cooperating with them. And now they potentially are about to get his entire phone records over the last couple years. You know, and to think, too, that this was a mistake on behalf of his own attorney, right? His attorney messed up, according to the Sandy Hook plaintiff's attorney, and sent him all these records. And then they were notified, hey, you might have accidentally sent us all these records. And they had 10 days to respond and try to, you know, I guess basically take them back or privilege them. And they chose not to, or they didn't do it. So, I mean, this whole thing's just insane.
I think the alternative theory there is perhaps Jones's lawyers knew that they had something in their possession that legally they had to give to the other side. And maybe they made it look like a mistake.
I've been watching this
right,
trial.
Wouldn't they get disbarred if they didn't hand over those messages?
If they knew, I think, right, that they had messages pertaining to the request for discovery,
right.
You know. So if they knew they had Sandy Hook messages and they didn't turn those over, I think that would be problematic for them. They might, I guess, say that they didn't know they had these, right? I don't really know.
Yeah, we don't want to get into conspiracy land.
I have no idea. But I will say I've watched a significant, you know, almost all of this trial, and the judge has on more than one occasion told Alex Jones's lawyer, "You should have learned this in the first year of law school. You cannot do that." She has scolded him regularly for breaking court rules.
Right.
And so having watched all that, I'm just not entirely sure how competent his legal representation is.
And there have also been moments, many moments, where the judge has showed frustration with Jones during this trial. I want to play an example of this. It's when Scarlett Lewis is speaking as a witness. And what strikes me as I listen to this is for the parents of the Sandy Hook victims to have Alex Jones on the air lying about their lives and lying about their dead children is a ghastly wound. It's something that you don't forget a day or two later. But for Alex Jones, he's just trying to fill airtime. Like, he's just trying to keep his show going. Like, he's up there, like, he's like a juggler with all these balls, just trying desperately not to drop any.
It's a circus.
For Alex Jones, it was just another day on the air. And for the parents, it was something they could never forget. And there's such a disconnect between the two sides there. Where for Jones, it's all sport and entertainment. It's the problem with some of these TV shows that are like, as you said, like a circus. Whereas for the parents, it's so real and so painful. So here is that moment from Jesse Lewis's mother, Scarlett.
To have someone on top of that perpetuate a lie, that it was a hoax, that it didn't happen, that it was a false flag, that I'm an actress. Then you get on and you say, oh, sorry, but I know actresses when I see them. Do you think I'm an actress?
No, I don't think you're
not. No, you can't talk right now.
And Oliver, another famous quote from the trial was, this is not your show. right? Basically, he had to repeatedly be told, this is not your show. You're not doing InfoWars in this courtroom.
Yeah, and it has really exposed how out of his element, I think, Alex Jones is. He's not used to being lectured and having to remain silent. He's not used to being admonished publicly and really, frankly, humiliated.
That's interesting. Usually he's on the offensive, right?
Right.
When in interactions he's had with you, also with you, Jennifer. Actually, Jennifer, you tell us about your experience first, because didn't he show up with a bullhorn when you were on a panel discussion in Austin?
He did. So he lives in Austin, and I was in a panel on him and weaponized communication and Donald Trump. And it was me and Jonathan Tylove from the Austin Statesman and Charlie Warzel. And he really came to attack Charlie Warzel, but he ended up attacking all three of us. He brought a camera crew. He had two cameras. He had two people, Confederates, who he had enlisted to pretend to attack him during the little proceeding. And it was amazing to watch. It was astounding. He was the director. He was the main character. And it was all a spectacle. And he posted it. He said, you know, that he was this free speech warrior. We were book burners and we were trying to silence him. And he kept putting it up on his InfoWars, you know, trying to make it seem more exciting than it was, you know, amplifying the crowd as if there was a big crowd there and that we, you know, people were booing him or something, which didn't happen. And it was all a spectacle, and it was fascinating to see it happen.
It was a show. He was trying to produce it. Didn't he pause to have people fix the camera orientation?
Yeah. So it was, of course, you know, Alex Jones shows up with the bullhorn, and I was listening to Charlie say something and looking over at him. And then all of a sudden, Alex Jones is sitting right in front of me with his bullhorn. And so, of course, I grab my phone, and so does everybody else. And so apparently I was holding my phone wrong. And so he's up there ranting and raving, and he'd been doing it for a few minutes, and he turns around, he looks at me, gets distracted by the fact that I'm holding my phone incorrectly, right? That I'm not going to capture him in this moment for him in its best light. And so he stops his rant in the middle of his rant. And he's like, yeah, honey, can you change the aspect ratio? You know, your phone, hold it the other way.
Amazing. Wow.
So I did. He was right. but yeah, I mean, it was fascinating. So I actually, you know, I invited him to break character and to sit down and join us and get a mic. You know, I was like, raised my hand and I waited for him to talk, to stop talking and to call on me. Mm-hmm. And so he looked at me and he let me ask my question, which was, you know, hey, do you want to join us? You know, you want to sit down, get a mic, a chair, we can have a conversation. Because I thought it would be really fascinating, you know, to hear him talk about what he does on InfoWars, you know, to really sort of debrief and to talk about it. But yeah, he said no, not interested in that.
No. Oliver, when he confronted you, he also had cameras all around him, right?
Yeah, it was pretty surreal. I was standing in line waiting to walk into this congressional hearing room, and he was just walking, storming the halls of Congress. I think earlier he had confronted Marco Rubio, and he saw me in line waiting to go in. And when Alex Jones goes somewhere, he goes with not just himself, not just one other person. It's this whole crew. And it's almost like other people see that it's Alex Jones and they just kind of add on. And you
right.
know, at the end
and
of the day,
he's
got like all these people following him around.
Yeah.
So anyway, they basically surround me, and Alex Jones is in the center, and there's all these cameras in my face. And he just started doing his show, basically in the middle of, you know, the halls of Congress, calling me all sorts of vile names and attacking me for things among things, wearing skinny jeans. I guess he's not a fan of those. And, you know, I mean, I don't know. There was nothing. I didn't participate in the show because I wasn't going to. So I just stood there. And then, you know, I think I took a couple pictures of him because it was like, this is, you know, this is an interesting moment in time.
Yeah.
But I just remember, you know, it was, I think it lasted about 10, 15 minutes, but it did feel like a bit of an eternity.
Yeah.
He's just like in my face. I like see his sweat on his like skin, you know, and he's like, I can almost see him like spitting, you know. It's like it had never been that close to him. And I don't know, a very, very, I would say unnerving experience.
Hmm. And in those cases, that's what I mean when I say he was on the offensive. You know, he was dominating. He was trying to control everything. And what we've seen through this trial is the opposite. I mean, I've heard him described as a coward, as someone sweating, you know, through his
coughing quite a bit.
What is the Alex Jones that you saw, Oliver, on the stand?
Yeah, I mean, watching him on trial, it's they're trying to paint a completely opposite picture of Alex Jones, not this. You know, person at the top of his game, but, you know, his attorney even has been basically saying InfoWars is not that influential. You know, it's not CNN, it's not the New York Times. This is a small, you know, he's trying to paint it as a small outlet.
Right.
It's led by a guy who's coughing all the time, who, you know, there's been issues about him coughing. They're really trying to paint, I think, a sympathetic character. And Alex Jones is, you know, after years of lying about Sandy Hook, going on the stand saying, oh, I believe it's 100% real now. Just a totally different character. I think almost like a caged animal.
Yeah.
Might be a good
like
description.
Trapped. He looks trapped. Yeah. And Jennifer, I've seen you say he himself is a crisis actor. That all of this about Sandy Hook, the lies about the children, They are predicated on this notion that, you know, it was staged in order to take your guns, and that the parents were crisis actors making stories up in order to help gun control. But Jennifer, you say actually Alex Jones is the crisis actor.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, what I've seen from him testifying is the coughing, the appeals, you know, to sympathy that Oliver mentioned. You know, he's trying to appear to be a victim. And, you know, that's very consistent with right-wing talking points. It's very consistent with how fascist rhetoric works, right? He's a martyr. He's a martyr for free speech. He's a martyr for the truth. He's the lone guy out there, you know, trying to fight for justice in reality or whatever. And he's trying to present himself that way. And, you know, he's suffered so much. He has this terrible cough, right? and so he's trying to, of course, elicit sympathy from the jury and from the judge, from the court, from the multiple audiences who are watching the trial unfold. And it just, you know, really rings false. I mean, he's not a good actor.
Yeah, I think where I come down on this is something that Matt LaBash wrote on his Substack today. He said, look around and what's become of Alex Jones's America. And, you know, talking about Donald Trump assisting, he won the election, et cetera, et cetera. He said, even if Alex Jones gets soaked by a jury, who's going to pay for all the ongoing lies? And that's kind of where I come away about this is Alex Jones and his lies about Sandy Hook, they seem to exist all around in all sorts of ways now. Versions of it, versions of that. That'll never go to trial, right? That'll never be held. There'll never be accountability. Is that too pessimistic to end a conversation on?
I think a little bit. I mean, I think we're seeing actually through the courthouse or the judicial system right now, the Dominion and Smartmatic lawsuits that are going through. I mean, there are legal avenues that people and companies can pursue when they feel they've been defamed or lied about. And I think, you know, these companies and organizations are going to be a lot more careful moving forward on some of these issues. You know, we've already seen Fox and others be more careful on election claims. Right. You saw Alex Jones testify that he doesn't even want to touch a mass shooting with a 10-foot pole anymore.
Yeah, that is interesting. He says that.
And
I barely talked about Uvalde, he says.
Yeah. And I mean, look, maybe baby steps. But I think 5-10 years ago, Alex Jones would have been talking about Uvalde, you know, all day.
Hmm.
And now, you know, there is, I think, acknowledgement from these guys that you can't just lie. And lie and defame and cause people pain because there are going to be consequences, or at least, at the very least, you might get tied up in court, which is annoying in itself.
Oliver Darcy, Jennifer Murcia, thank you both for the conversation.
It's my pleasure.
Thank you, Brian.
And that's a wrap here on this week's Reliable Sources podcast. Thank you for tuning in. We'll see you on TV this Sunday, every Sunday, 11 a.m. Eastern time on CNN. And make sure you're on the list for our nightly newsletter as well. Sign up for free at reliablesources.com. Thank you for tuning in.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.